25 years ago today, on April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was shot dead on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. He was 39. King had gone to Memphis to support striking sanitation workers. That effort, like most of the civil rights campaigns that King led, took place in the South. Before he died, though, King did take his nonviolent movement north. In 1966, King went to Chicago. There, he and his supporters faced violent counter-demonstrations in the streets and political resistance in City Hall. Some historians contend that the movement in Chicago failed to achieve its goals. On this anniversary of King's death, NPR's Cheryl Duvall re-examines that judgment with some who participated in those events.
Chicago, Martin Luther King said in 1966, is the place where the people of Mississippi ought to come to learn how to hate. But he came to that conclusion only after a difficult summer that began with high hopes for goals that King described in a speech before the Chicago Society of Professional Journalists.
Our intention is to make Chicago one city. At present, it is two cities. And everything that we do, whether it's in the realm of open housing, which leaves us with a dual housing market, whether it's in the realm of education, which leaves us with a dual school system, or whether it's in the economic realm, which leaves us with a dual economy, so to speak, everything that we do is an attempt to make this one city and to do away with the duality that surrounds every community in our country.
With his aides from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Chicago community organizers, King was trying to do in the North what the freedom movement had attempted in the South, to expose and begin to dismantle the patterns of racial discrimination. Those patterns were well established in Chicago. At that time, blacks were 25% of the city's population, but most lived on only 10% of the land, south and west of downtown.
We could not cross certain boundaries.
Georgia Palmer, in 1966, was a neighborhood activist, a member of the committee that invited Martin Luther King to Chicago.
We went only so far south. We only went so far north. And if you went across those boundaries, you would get beaten or killed.
Fear of bodily harm was not the only element that confined black Chicagoans to certain neighborhoods. Through restrictive covenants, high-interest mortgages, and redlining, the city's banking and real estate interests maintained rigid racial boundaries. These businesses had a powerful friend in City Hall, Richard J. Daley, who was elected mayor of Chicago in 1955. That was the same year Martin Luther King rose to prominence, leading the bus boycotts in Montgomery, Alabama. Chicago lawyer Len Dupre was an alderman then, one of Daley's few white opponents on the Chicago City Council.
Daley's main job as a political leader was to keep the lid on blacks. He needed the white voters to be willing supporters of his because he kept the lid on the blacks. And he needed the black wards because he had, through the distribution of patronage, the ability to control the vote in the black wards. You see, the vote in the black precincts was always overwhelmingly for Daley. He was terrified when Martin Luther King Jr. came to Chicago.
By that summer, King had been in the national eye for 10 years. Although he had won the Nobel Peace Prize, he was by no means universally admired by whites or blacks. And while Mayor Daley was terrified of King's influence, King was perplexed by this mayor who seemed the very model of gracious diplomacy. Edward Marciniak was a Daley appointee, director of the Chicago Commission on Human Relations.
I sat in on a personal meeting with Martin Luther King and the mayor. And here were two guys sizing each other up, trying to figure out who they were. On the one hand, the mayor is saying, what is this outsider doing here? Is he going to mess things up for us? And the other hand, there's Martin Luther King trying to figure out with the mayor, are we going to get what we want? He's not saying no.
In fact, Mayor Daley did say yes to many of the Chicago movement's initial demands. This created a dilemma, says Robert Lucas, who was the Chicago chairman for the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE.
If Mayor Daley had some opposition on some issue and he felt that it was really going to be amplified through demonstrations, what have you, he would try to co-opt you.
When activists complained about rats in slum apartments, for example, the mayor would send city crews to place rat poison in the alleys. But such measures did nothing to alter the relative position of blacks and whites held in place by housing segregation. Realizing this, the Chicago movement focused on ending racial discrimination in the city's housing market. Georgia Palmer describes how she and hundreds of other volunteers prepared their case by inquiring at real estate offices about properties in segregated neighborhoods.
That was called testing of real estate. And what was invaluable was all of the white students that came from all over the world going out there for us. Because oftentimes, they would be allowed to purchase the property, and we had just gotten turned down.
As soon as they got the information, Reverend James Bevel of King's staff and Al Raby, a former Chicago school teacher turned organizer, dispatched peaceful demonstrators to the neighborhoods most resistant to racial change. During 6 weeks that summer, hundreds of marchers descended on the banks, real estate offices, and residential blocks in those areas every day. Some of those demonstrations took place in Mayor Daley's own neighborhood, prompting a growing number of reporters from outside Chicago to question the mayor's assertion that the city was for everybody. Former Human Relations Director Ed Marciniak.
The issue really was to stop the marches, because the marches at that point were creating or triggering reactions which could lead to serious strife.
But many Chicagoans agreed with King that the confrontations were necessary, says Monsignor John Egan, who was active in the city's Catholic Interracial Council. In 1966, Egan was pastor of a largely black parish on the west side, near the apartment in which King lived in Chicago. Egan says his parishioners were proud to have the civil rights leader as a neighbor.
What he did was take the cover off respectability and show the hatred and the antagonism that existed amongst many of the white people and many of the neighborhoods regarding the blacks moving in.
The respectable cover of one of the most segregated cities in America was violently torn off on July 31, 1966. That Sunday, the Chicago movement gathered one of its largest demonstrations, more than 5,000 blacks and whites led by King. The organizers' plan was to hold a prayer vigil at a Southwest Side bank, then march to Marquette Park. Georgia Palmer was there.
By our research, they had determined that this was the area that we were going to get the greatest resistance. And the researchers and analysts were correct. We almost got destroyed. We were just like Custer going up on the Little Bighorn that Sunday.
Between the bank and the park, the marchers passed through an area of modest, well-kept bungalows in an all-white community determined to stay that way. Bob Lucas also marched near the front with King.
There were probably 30,000 whites in the Marquette Park that particular day, and you could see the hate on their faces as the screaming. You could just see it, just deep hatred. And they were throwing these rocks and bottles and chair bombs and what have you, and one hit Dr. King in the head. It knocked him down, and then immediately people that were around him fell on top of him, you know, to keep him from receiving other blows.
And then Reverend Jesse Jackson ran down the march to us and told us to keep going. They were just keeping up the courage of the marchers. They were singing and trying to keep us distracted. But it's hard to stay distracted, hard to sing when any moment you don't know whether some crabapple is going to take your eye out.
Marchers were falling all around, says Georgia Palmer. Others picked them up and carried them along the two-mile stretch to Ashland Avenue, where a black neighborhood and safety began. All the while, she recalls, angry white residents pressed in on the marchers, blocking their escape, setting on fire the cars of the ministers who had driven to the park.
White women were running and had bags of sugar, and some of their children, now their little children, were holding the gasoline tank over for mama to load this gasoline tank up with Domino and C&H. We could see the bags and the labels. And even Mayor Daley had not expected the vituperative, venomous response.
Images from that march, transmitted around the world, brought to a head the standoff between Daley and King. The mayor could no longer dismiss the freedom movement's demands by claiming that he ran a fair city, and the civil rights leader had exhausted his tactics in Chicago, says former alderman Len Dupre.
I was called one Saturday morning to a meeting of black office holders, and Martin Luther King Jr. came to the meeting, and he told us that they just couldn't go any further, but that they had to have some kind of victory so that they could withdraw without loss of prestige, and that they wanted our help in achieving that. King was really announcing a surrender, and they worked out a formula for King to leave town.
That formula included a summit of major Chicago bankers, realtors, religious and labor leaders. Over 2 weeks in August, they convened for painful negotiations and hammered out non-Biden guidelines to promote integration in the city and suburbs. With Daley and King, the summit leaders signed an agreement creating an independent fair housing agency, the Leadership Council for Metropolitan Open Communities, which exists to this day.
That's why you get contrary opinions as to whether the freedom movement won or lost.
Ed Marciniak now studies the results of the movement as director of the Institute of Urban Life at Loyola University in Chicago.
I say the freedom movement won because we got the Leadership Council for Metropolitan Open Communities out of it. We had the business community and other civic leaders espousing fair housing. So they were on our side. They were on the side, too, of the freedom movement. And they went about their business in a systematic way to open the housing market.
Which is not to say the housing market opened up in a spirit of goodwill. Integration, Chicagoans bitterly joked, became the brief period between the time the first black family moved into a neighborhood and the last white family moved out. Georgia Palmer stayed in a black neighborhood. She now runs a florist business out of her home on Martin Luther King Boulevard. The real beneficiaries of the open housing campaign, she believes, were the realtors, the so-called panic peddlers, who convinced whites that it was in their best interest to sell their houses quickly to blacks.
All of a sudden, houses were for sale everywhere, and blacks just started advancing, crossing Halsted, crossing Ashland. And more of my friends would say, you know, Dr. So-and-so and so-and-so just bought in Beverly.
Bob Lucas, now director of a Southside community organization, eventually bought his own house in Beverly, but initially he denounced the summit agreement as a sellout. Lucas says that Martin Luther King was stung by that kind of criticism, and he left Chicago in September 1966, doubting whether he had succeeded.
I think he was somewhat sad. There's still not much integration in Chicago, but I moved to Beverly in 75, and I know that was a direct result of Dr. King and the freedom movement being here in 1966.
Beverly, on the southwestern edge of the city, is one of the few middle-class communities that integrated peacefully as a result of the summit. But other southwest side neighborhoods, including Marquette Park, began to stagnate. What happened there in 1966 prompted many whites to move away to the suburbs and many blacks to refrain from moving in. Jim Caprero, director of the Greater Southwest Development Corporation, saw the Marquette Park area begin to lose residents and businesses shortly after he witnessed the march through his neighborhood when he was 16. And he's just beginning to see the area open up to settlement by people of all races.
We're on 63rd Street, walking west towards Tallman Avenue. And you can see a lot of folks milling around. There are black children, there are white children, there are Spanish children.
Some developers believe that Marquette Park and surrounding areas have the potential to become Chicago's next hot neighborhood. Its single-family bungalows and low-rise apartment buildings are generally in good shape. For now, anyway, they're much less expensive than similar housing stock elsewhere in the city. Later this year, a new rapid transit line will finally link the area to downtown Chicago. And gradually, Jim Caprero says, Marquette Park is overcoming its racially charged history.
There's a site that is now a video store in 1966 that was a real estate office called Rio Realty. And that is where there was a picket line formed by the open housing forces that were gathered in Chicago, literally a block away from where that Rio real estate office is. That's a racially integrated senior citizen building right here in the Marquette Park community, where there was a protest and a conflict in 1966.
Still, Capraro and others readily admit that Chicago is far from erasing its ugly reputation. Blacks and growing numbers of Latinos and Asians do inhabit more areas of the city and suburbs than they did 27 years ago. But recent sociological studies have called Chicago hyper-segregated, a city in which people of different races still live largely in isolation from one another. After September 1966, Martin Luther King returned to Chicago only briefly. In the last 19 months of his life, he was pulled in many directions, challenging the U.S. war against Vietnam, tending to conflicts within the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and lending his support to civil rights protests throughout the nation. It was one such campaign, a strike by sanitation workers, that took King to Memphis, where he was assassinated 25 years ago today. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.